Greetings, listeners. This is VK3OTN, the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old-Timers Club of Australia, with this month's news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club for October 2023. I am Andrew, a VK3 Charlie Alpha Hotel. Details on when to hear the news and information bulletins are available at the club's website, www.raotc.org.au. VK3OTN is available on a wide range of radio platforms, HF, VHF and UHF, along with 2-metre repeaters, amateur television, DMR, that is digital mobile radio, and D-Star. These news broadcasts are available for download for up to 6 months, just in case you missed the original news broadcast from the RAOTC website. Just put RAOTC into your favourite search engine. If you'd like to contact the club, then why not send us an email? Our address is raotc@raotc.org.au. I hope you enjoy this month's news broadcast. Welcome to the October 2023 edition of RAOTC Club News. At the most recent committee meeting held on August 24, our long-time editor indicated that the latest OTN will be his very last. The committee is appreciative of those who stepped forward to assist with proofreading, and 4 members proofread the September 23 issue. At the recent AGM held via teleconference using Zoom on the 21st of September, 28 voting members and 1 associate member attended from all over Australia, which was really pleasing to see. And we thank the members who attended. Our long-time editor, Bill, VK3BR, indicated he would not be standing for committee. Both our former editor and proofreader are at a stage where age has caught up with them and they simply are unable to continue to serve in their former roles. We are setting up a publications committee to produce the OTN Journal. A member who has experience in desktop publishing has volunteered to do the laying out, and 4 members have offered to do copy editing before the layout stage. We will separate out the layout and desktop work from the rest of the publication process to spread the work out amongst the editorial team. By now, members should have received the September 2023 edition of OTN, with a new bunch of articles written by our members for our members. If you're not a member as yet, you can view the September 22 edition of OTN on the club's website, with the exception of the membership list. Melbourne Luncheons. When you book for the RATC Luncheons, if you're paying by cash over the counter at a Bendigo bank or via internet banking, we request you provide your membership number and call sign. Please place your booking form to the RATC PO Box address or advise us of your booking details via the RATC email address, which is raotc@raotc.org.au. This leads me on to the next topic. When I joined RAOTC, Bill Roper, VK3BR, was doing more than his fair share of the workload, and Bill has announced he will not be continuing on committee and has completely stepped down altogether. Please don't contact Bill directly in regard to RAOTC activities. By all means, correspond with Bill along with others on a personal basis. Messages about RAOTC matters should be sent to the administrative officer, which is raotc@raotc.org.au. Broadcasts. Feedback I've received in recent times indicate the historical broadcasts that I supply every second month are rather well received. Many members reminisce about the days past. Many operators mentioned are now silent keys and so on. There have been suggestions that I should sit down and selectively edit out bits and pieces that are no longer relevant from these historical broadcasts. This is not going to happen. They are provided as an interim program until someone else picks up and helps carry the weight. It is either this or nothing. Whoever steps forward is free to produce the broadcast in any format they want, so they may well do it differently from the way I've put it together. There is no hard and fast rule. I just base my content on what my predecessors use as a template. Some old technical talks from years past, along with some new ones, most of which many listeners will be hearing for the first time. New members. This month we have two new members. Today I am pleased to welcome the following new members to REOTC. AJ Reinman, VK5 Alpha Juliet Radio, and a new member from Scotland, David Searle. Mike Zero, Hotel Quebec Delta. Silent Keys. Sometimes details are a little slow at reaching the membership officer, which is understandable. It is with regret I report the following silent keys. Mac McDermott, VK5, Foxtrot, Lima Echo November, ROTC member number 1631, became a silent key in January 2023. Max Mondolo, VK2 Alpha Mike Lima, ROTC member number 1227, became a silent key earlier this year. Exact details are not currently at hand. Kevin Trevathan, VK3 Victor Charlie, ROTC member 1115, became a silent key in June. Bill Fanning, VK3 Delta Whiskey Foxtrot, ROTC member 1038, became a silent key on the 20th of July 2023. Derek McNeil, VK3 X-Ray Yankee, ROTC member 1370, became a silent key on the 28th of July 2023. David Davies, VK3 Mike Hotel Victor, ROTC member number 1293, became a silent key on the 3rd of August 2023. Dennis Babel, VK3 Juliet November, ROTC member number 1756, became a silent key on the 1st of September 2023. Let us pause a moment in memory of our departed colleagues. Members are reminded that the very latest club news is available via the REOTC website. Put REOTC into your favourite search engine to find it. www.raotc.org.au. And that's all the club news we have for you at this time. The following obituary for Derek McNeil was received from Ron, VK3 Alpha Foxtrot Whiskey. Over to you, Ron.
Derek McNeil, VK3XY, previously VK3ZVG, VK3NKY, GHOLN, and VK3BYA, became a silent key on Friday, 28th of July, 2023. He was born in the UK on the 22nd of March, 1944. Derek developed a love of the outdoors, riding across the countryside on horses and sailing with his father while a teenager. He was working as a chartered accountant when he met his future wife, who was studying in the UK. They both shared a sense of adventure, and soon after he emigrated to Australia, where they were married. His first amateur license was obtained in Australia. Derek was a long-time member of the WIA, as an active member of WISN, especially during the Ash Wednesday fires and the Mount Macedon fires. Derek also served as Treasurer of the WIA Vic, later ARV, Treasurer and member of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club from 2006 to 2017. and was a regular attendee at the Moorabbin and District's Radio Club meetings. He was a member of the Queensland Flotilla VF9 of the Volunteer Coast Guard for 15 years as a crew member and later coxswain. Derek took up sonar activating, but this was curtailed by failing eyesight. He is survived by his wife Margaret, two sons, David and Peter, his daughter Anna, and two grandchildren, Jesse and Sophie. Derek was a genuine gentleman who will be missed by all who knew him. Farewell, Derek. This is Ron, VK3AFW.
You are listening to VK3OTN. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
This month we have several articles for you. First up is Clive Wallace, a VK6CSW, who will be talking about the Earth Inductor Compass. This will be followed by Bill Roper, a VK3BR, who tells us about the AA3 Mark 7 Gunfire Control System. Have you got your own copy of OTN on disc yet? Now, it's over to you, Clive.
The Earth Inductor Compass. Charles Lindbergh, the first man to fly solo across the Atlantic, landed safely at Le Bourget Field in Paris at 10:22 p.m. on the 20th of May 1927. The single-engined Spirit of St. Louis had carried him over 3,600 miles in 33.5 hours. On the 9th of June 1928, a Fokker F7 trimotor monoplane named Southern Cross, piloted by Charles Kingsford Smith, touched down at Brisbane's Eagle Farm Aerodrome to complete the first crossing of the Pacific Ocean by air. One vital navigational instrument that these pioneer aviators had in common was the Earth Inductor Compass, without which neither voyage may have succeeded. From the time man first discovered lodestone until the advent of inertial navigation systems and, nowadays, global positioning satellites, the magnetic compass has played a major role in terrestrial navigation. It developed from a piece of naturally occurring magnetized rock suspended on a string to a highly complex, accurate, and reliable means of determining magnetic direction. A simple magnetic Boy Scout-type compass was probably the first navigational instrument ever fitted to an aeroplane. You may be surprised to learn that even today a simple, direct-reading magnetic compass is required by law to be fitted to all aircraft. Even the latest glass cockpit electronic marvels have one clearly visible to the pilots. When everything else, electric and electronic, has failed, it just might save the day. On the face of it, fitting a magnetic compass to an aircraft seems simple enough. Pop the thing in the cockpit, where it can easily be seen, add a few compensating magnets to take care of residual magnetism caused by any ferrous material in the surrounding structure, calibrate it with compass swing, and off we go. Unfortunately, it's not quite that simple. The magnetic compass is designed to sense only the horizontal component of the Earth's magnetic field, but the lines of force are parallel to the Earth's surface only at the equator. At all other latitudes, the lines are tilted until becoming essentially vertical at the magnetic poles. To keep the compass card or needle in the horizontal plane, it needs to be slightly pendulous. Without going into too much detail, in an aircraft, this leads to acceleration and turning errors and may cause quite severe compass gyrations in turbulence. Over the years, much effort has gone into solving these shortcomings. One early attempt to improve on the basic aeronautical magnetic compass was the Earth Inductor. A simple dynamo works by spinning a coil in the field of a permanent magnet. Positioning the commutator to tap off the voltage while the coil is cutting the maximum number of lines of magnetic force will output the highest voltage. Similarly, if we spin a vertical coil in the Earth's magnetic field, it will generate a voltage which will be greatest when the coil's windings cut the field at a right angle. Rotating the device to produce maximum output means that it must be at right angles to the horizontal component of the Earth's magnetic field, and therefore indicating magnetic north or south. At any other angle, a lesser voltage will be generated, becoming zero when magnetically east or west. Since the output varies with the sine of the angle to the magnetic field, it should be possible to calibrate the output to read magnetic heading on a galvanometer scale. Attractive as this idea is, it will produce identical maxima whether pointing north or south, and minima when east or west, a potential navigational embarrassment. Also, of course, the Earth's magnetic field is very weak compared with the dynamo's magnets, and the voltage generated is correspondingly small. An American, Donald M. Bliss, used this idea in his Earth Inductor Compass, patented in 1912, the aim being to provide a more stable instrument than the simple magnetic compass. To solve the north-south ambiguity problem, his original design used two armatures spinning vertically on a common axis, with two sets of commutators, one for each armature, aligned at 90 degrees to each other. Each commutator was connected to its own sensitive galvanometer. Thus, when one set of commutators was aligned with the Earth's magnetic field, no current was generated while the other set produced maximum voltage. As the instrument was rotated relative to the Earth's line of magnetic force, so the readings on the galvanometers varied, and the readings could be calibrated in terms of magnetic heading. The idea was good, but the readings could be upset by variations in the rotational speed of the armatures, and also by stray magnetism. By gimbal mounting the instrument, the gyroscopic action of the rotating armatures tended to keep them spinning stably in the vertical axis. While sound in principle, the instrument would have been cumbersome to operate. Maurice Maxey Titterington, born in 1891, graduated from Washington's Bliss Electrical School in 1913. In 1914, he learned to fly at the Curtis Flying School, and in 1918 was working for the Sperry Gyroscope Corporation. A year later, he and Bryce Herbert Goldsborough, an instrument designer at Sperry and a fellow aviator, founded the Pioneer Instrument Company. By 1924, Titterington, who was included in the 1925 edition of Who's Who in American Aviation, had revisited Bliss's idea and developed the first really practical Earth Inductor Compass, patented in 1924. Just as it is much easier for a person when radio direction finding to detect an aural null rather than a maximum signal, so it's easier to detect a zero voltage from an Earth inductor rather than a maximum. The revised design allowed the user to rotate the commutators in such a way that zero current would be produced when the craft was traveling in the intended direction. A single galvanometer was then used to show if the pilot was steering too far to the left or to the right. In other words, the pilot could preset the required magnetic heading and maintain it simply by keeping the center zero reading galvanometer on the zero mark. North-south ambiguity was also taken care of. If the pilot inadvertently set off on a reciprocal track, making what appeared to be the proper correction to regain heading would increase the needle movement further away from the center zero mark. This metering arrangement also meant that armature speed was less critical. An on-heading zero reading would be unaffected, while an off-heading signal output simply meant a slightly lesser needle movement if the armature speed was lower. The armature was usually powered by a small slipstream-driven propeller through a universal joint, the pendulosity and gyroscopic effects keeping the generating system vertical in order to detect only the horizontal magnetic component. The other major improvement Titterington made was to make the movable commutator mechanism remotely operated via a Bowden cable connected to a calibrated crank in the cockpit, enabling the inductor to be remotely located in the aircraft, well away from unwanted magnetic influences such as engines or steel structures. From the pilot's perspective, he could crank in the required magnetic heading and then fly it by keeping the galvanometer needle centered. The first major success for Tittering's EIC came quickly. In 1923, the U.S. Army Air Service commissioned the Douglas Aircraft Company to build four special World Cruiser aircraft to attempt a round-the-world flight in 1924. Each was fitted with an earth inductor compass, and although only two of the aircraft completed the arduous 27,553-mile flight, taking 371 hours and 11 minutes, the EICs performed well. When Charles Lindbergh made the first solo crossing of the Atlantic in his Spirit of St. Louis in May 1927, he relied on his Pioneer EIC for navigation. Without it, he may well not have succeeded. Prior to his successful attempt to cross the Pacific in 1928, Charles Kingsford Smith insisted that the Southern Cross be fitted with a Pioneer Company earth inductor compass. He realized that on the first and second legs to Hawaii and then Fiji, the destinations were easy to miss, and already several attempts to fly from America's west coast to the Hawaiian Islands had ended in tragedy through navigational errors. In the Southern Cross, the navigator, Harry Lyon, could select the required magnetic course from his desk while the indicating galvanometer was located on the pilot's instrument panel. Although the aircraft also carried three traditional magnetic compasses, Smithy claimed that the EIC was the most valuable steering instrument that we carried. Unfortunately, Titterington didn't live long enough to truly benefit from his success. In 1928, he took off in a Travel Air 5000 single-engine monoplane, headed across the Pennsylvania mountains, and crashed to his death during bad weather after the aircraft was struck by lightning. Although the EIC was further developed by others, a decade or so later, the Fluxgate and Gyro Compass systems had eclipsed the EIC, though both used the basic idea developed by the Pioneer Company. Following Titterington's death in 1928, Pioneer was acquired by the Bendix Corporation. As the United States was entering World War II, the company became the Pioneer Instrument Division of Bendix Aviation and moved to New Jersey. By 1943, it had become the Eclipse Pioneer Division of Bendix Aviation, producing, amongst other things, the latest in aviation compasses.
Thanks very much, Clive.
You are listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations. VK3OTN is the official station of the Radio Amateurs Old Timers Club, Australia, Incorporated, with the monthly news and information bulletin for members and friends of the club.
AAE 3 Mark 7 Gunfire Control System. Here is part of an interesting email received from Craig Cook, VK3KG, RAOTC member number 931. And Craig writes, "What an interesting read I had this time of the September 2012 issue of OTN magazine. I was very interested in the article by Peter VK3RV on radar and the involvement of Alan Butement and Philip Pollard in 1931. This was leading up to the war years and the chain home system. My interest was piqued when I saw mention of involvement with the gunfire control system known as the AA-3 Mark 7. I am familiar with this system as it was the first radar I was trained on in the Army, and it was by then modified for a field role of tracking mortar bombs in flight. In its usual application in anti-aircraft, it was known as a fire control radar, and used to put on the 3.7-inch AA guns via a predictor unit to the target. The 3 Mark VII took initial search data either from a visual application or another radar known as a tactical control radar that had different characteristics from the 3 Mark VII. As Australia decommissioned our anti-aircraft system in the middle 1950s, these radars and guns became obsolete. But the 3 Mark VIIs were still used as weather balloon tracking, and with a small modification to readout displays, were then used by the Army for location of hostile enemy mortars. These were used in the regular Army as well as the CMF, later known as Army Reserve, until we purchased the American Field Mortar Locator, the AN/KPQ-1, around 1965. The 3 Mark VII also saw service at Woomera during the rocket trials in the 1960s. And there is a chapter in Fire Across the Desert by Peter Morton, an AGPS publication. These radars now reside in a couple of places on display or personal collections. The other tactical control radar seem to have been totally lost, and I've not been able to locate any in captivity. Perhaps it may be because of the frequency of operation that fell into the middle of the old black and white TV band allocation, and authorities didn't want any high-powered jammers being towed around the countryside. Thanks, Craig, for that very interesting item. You're listening to VK3OTN and associated relay stations.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Perth Luncheons. The popular and well-attended monthly luncheons for RAOTC members and friends in and around the Perth area are held on the second Tuesday of each month. The VK6 RAOTC group have a new venue, the Woodbridge Hotel, 50 East Street, East Guildford. Reports indicate the hospitality to be excellent. The Perth group meet at 11:30 a.m. for lunch at 12 midday. This is not a buffet meal, but excellent food in both pensioner and standard portions are available. We would like to place the orders at 12 midday, so please don't be late. This information is courtesy of Phil, VK6ZKO, whose contact details can be found on the club website.
In keeping with tradition, we conclude this broadcast with a short story entitled A Golfer's Wisdom. A young man was just about to start a round of golf when an elderly gentleman walked over to ask if he could join him. And despite misgivings that the older player might slow him down, the younger one agreed. To his surprise and delight, the old man was a quick player. He only ever hit his drives about 150 yards, but he was no slouch along the fairways. Eventually they reached the 10th hole, where the younger player hooked his drive into a plantation, leaving himself with a tall pine tree standing between his ball and the green. Seeing his opponent's predicament, the old man volunteered, "When I was your age, I used to hit the ball right over that tree to the green." Without stopping to think, so eager was he to show off his skills, the young man took an almighty swing at the ball and then watched in horror as it thudded into the tree trunk and rebounded 20 yards behind him. The old man remained silent for a few seconds before remarking, "Of course, when I was your age, that pine tree was only 3 feet tall."
That's all we have for you this month, and we hope you found something of interest. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you will join in the callbacks where callbacks are taken. The next RAOTC news and information broadcast will take place on the first Monday of next month, on the same frequencies and at the same times as today, with the exception of January. If you have missed all a part of this broadcast, or you just want to listen to it again, it is available for download from the RAOTC website. Simply go to www.raotc.org.au. Again, the website URL is www.raotc.org.au. On the right-hand side is the main menu. Click on VK3OTN Broadcasts and you will be able to see the various times and frequencies of the VK3OTN. transmissions by all of our volunteers, provided of course a volunteer is available. Down towards the bottom of the page is the current and previous 5 broadcasts for you to listen to. Sometimes the relay station is an automated broadcast, for example, a repeater, when no operator is available to take callbacks. Other times the volunteer operator suffers from very heavy local queue iron and callbacks are not always possible. Many operators need a small amount of time to switch from playing a recorded file to using a microphone. Please be mindful of this. This is VK3OTN signing clear from today's news and information session. 73 from the IOTC broadcast team.